Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we are going to talk with you about raptors coming up next here. Raptor rehabilitation. It's kind of the front line of wildlife health. And our guest with us by phone today is Marge Gibson. Marge is with the Raptor Education Group of Antigo, Wisconsin. She's well-known licensed raptor rehabilitator. She's going to be the featured speaker for the Madison Audubon Society Spring Banquet. That's Tuesday, March 8th, I think from 5:30 to 9. It'll be at the UW-Madison Memorial Union on Langdon Street. And we can tell you how to get tickets for that. I'll be there, too. It's going to be a lot of fun. I was Master of Ceremonies last year, and they asked me back, and so I'm going to do it again and really looking forward to that. But we're going to spend some time on rehabilitating raptors with her, and certainly if you have some questions, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Marge with us by phone. Hi, Marge.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
Doing great.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you again at the Spring Banquet for Madison Audubon Society. That should be a lot of fun.
It should be, and we have some really great birds to bring along, too, so that'll kind of add some more flavor.
It sure will. The Raptor Education Group, it's a nonprofit organization, and you care for all kinds of avian wildlife, do you not?
That's right. Everything from the eagles and trumpeter swans down to hummingbirds.
And you've been around for a fairly long time now.
Yeah, a really long time. We've actually been up in Antigo since 1990, but I've been doing rehabilitation for about 40 years.
You know, this is a little bit of an aside in a way, but I know the Supreme Court is hearing an appeal from Exxon on the amount of fine they got for the Exxon Valdez disaster. And you were involved with bald eagles following that oil spill, were you not? What are your memories of that incident?
You know, it was a difficult time. I think that, you know, there were highs and lows as there are in any disaster. But, I did the Eagle Capture and Health Assessment Program in 1989 and through 93.
It must have been a difficult thing to have to work on.
It was. I think that, you know, the beauty up there was sort of unsettling in a way because you have this incredibly beautiful area. And then when combined with a disaster of that magnitude, it was the yin and the yang, I think, of wildlife.
When you look at raptors here in Wisconsin, how many are brought to your group every year? Do you keep track of that? Or?
Oh yes, we have to keep track for the state and the federal government. We do about 1,000 birds a year, and many of which are the state threatened and endangered species.
And what's the? You feel like you have a pretty good success rate with them?
We do, and we're really proud of our success rate, but I think that one thing that we do is we take, you know, a lot of ours is really personal time, and so we pull them through that way.
Yeah, and I know you're part of a West Nile virus monitoring study. What's that all about?
Well, years ago, when this first started, I think that wildlife rehabilitators were the first people who came across West Nile virus. We were finding it in our patients. And the state has since instituted doing throat swabs and swabbing and doing cultures of any of the birds that we think might have West Nile from that point on.
So that's kind of a way to get some idea of which birds are being affected and how many.
It is, and which species. That has changed. Every year it does change somewhat. Different species are affected, which is something we were not really expecting, and I think that that's one of the surprises that's come out of this.
So there are more species that are being affected than was previously thought.
That's true, and different species in different years. The thought is that the virus mutates slightly every year, and it affects, you know, it's sort of a little bit of a different virus each year, and so it affects different species and in different ways.
Well, we have some callers online to visit with you. By the way, again, you can join in if you have a question for Marge. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Let's turn to Mike in Castle Rock. Mike, hi.
Good morning. I've got a couple of questions. I just thought of another one. What's your experience with Cooper's hawks? And secondly, in Illinois, we used to get, at the museum I worked at, a lot of saw-whet owls. And if we kept them for a period of time, they they had eye problems. I'd like to know what your comments are on those.
Cooper's hawks, of course, are excipitors, and they're very fast-flying, more birding-type hawks. And we tend to see them more around bird feeders. They've really adapted to, you know, the human smorgasbord of feeding birds. So that, I guess, would answer that unless you had something more there.
Well, yeah, the rehabilitation.
Well, they're very high-strung, and so they have to be rehabilitated in specialized enclosures, which are sort of more enclosed than other types of birds that are not quite as high-strung. But they can't. I mean, but they do well. They do have to have specialized things like tail savers so they don't break their feathers and things like that. But it's you know, given that they do fine. Your question on saltwood owls. Saltwood's eyes are kind of inefficient in some ways. They need a lot more natural tears, and I think in captivity, what happens is they need more humidity. And we use artificial tears a lot here to put in their eyes while they're with us, and it seems to help a lot.
Interesting. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Marge, let's talk a little bit about training. What kind of person becomes, or what kind of training, I should say, do you need to be a rehabilitator?
You know, that's kind of an interesting question, because years ago there was no training at all. I think that, you know, it was seen more of a hobby, you know, someone who found a little bird and then it sort of, you know, increased from there. And, you know, they just sort of took care of it without any training. Now a lot of facilities are requiring, and in fact our facility is requiring, a biology background or a captive wildlife background. And in that way, there's a lot of the physiology needed to take care of the species.
Yeah. So so a little training in biology along with the training that you – do you provide training yourself then?
We do a lot of training here. But a big part of working with wildlife is knowing what they're like in the wild. In other words, their natural history. That way you can return them to a natural situation and be able to give them what they need while they're in captivity. So that's really a huge part of wildlife rehabilitation. Not so much, you know, taking care of them, but really having that additional information.
And you do have to wear quite a few hats in this wildlife rehabilitator.
It's really multifaceted, and it just seems like, you know, there's new hats to put on all the time, I guess.
Well, there's, you know, you think about just feeding, you know, you have to be aware of their nutritional needs and their behavior, obviously, as you say. And you kind of got to be a naturalist.
All those things are really important, especially for the little birds, the passerines, insectivores. A lot of them eat only insects, and some of them eat only certain types of insects during certain phases of their life. So we actually end up learning a lot about the species by the close contact that we have with them, and it's fascinating, but it is pretty time-consuming, and you're always thinking.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. Tell us a story maybe about or two about some recent cases that you've had or some cases over the years that have kind of struck your fancy.
You know, everyone is just so incredible. I think, you know, it's hard to pick out one. We've had, you know, some cases like, you know, bald eagles. I think probably in some ways they're the ones who really strike you, because when they come to us, no matter what it is, if it's being hit by a car or shot, and there are still a lot of eagles shot, unfortunately, in our state, and or poisonings, they're so vulnerable at that point in time, and we're not used to thinking or seeing bald eagles in a vulnerable place. So those are the ones that really strike you the most, I think, and have been you know, some of the most incredible patients. But again, they're all incredible. Trumpeter swans, they all have different sort of general personalities and things that make them endearing.
Yeah, what's the eagle like, for example? What's the personality of an injured eagle when it comes in?
Well, if they trust you, and a lot of it is trust as predators, they tend to be able to evaluate their environment constantly. So they they really have a good handle on whether, you know, you're somebody who's going to hurt them or someone who's going to help them. They're pretty low-key patients, quite honestly. Hmm. I wouldn't suggest anyone run out and pick one up, but, you know, on the whole, they're much more low-key than Mike had asked a question about a Cooper's Hawk, a much more nervous type of patient and requires a different type of approach.
I would guess so. You, you know, I know you have a large flight training facility at your location, and when I think about flight training, I think about these big landing strips and towers, control towers, and everything. What does your flight training facility look like?
Not really all that different, actually. we have a huge building, and it's a building because we use it, you know, obviously through the winter months, which we tend to have a lot of snow up here in the Anigo area. It's 110 feet long, 60 foot wide, and 28 feet high. And when we think about it, the birds that come in with injuries or starvation don't have a muscle mass, so they really have to develop that. And physical therapy is the way to do it, and they can't go out till they're perfect again. So that kind of flight training is incredibly important to their success once they're released.
And, as I thought about it, I was thinking, well, now you've got a wild bird. It's injured, but maybe it's starting to get better. How do you get it out there to get it exercise and then get it to come back to you? Or how do you exercise a bird that might want to be getting away from you?
Yeah, well, there is that. It's just one of those hats that you wear, I guess. actually, most of the time, they're very cooperative. They, you know, you don't put them out into a large flight until they're really ready to go out and are eating on their own and, you know, can be outside in whatever temperature it is and be able to interact with the other birds that are in that facility. So they kind of go from, you know, critical care and which would be a more confined area to a smaller flight building and then, you know, into the larger flight. And they actually are pretty cooperative.
And when you release them in the end, do most of them just take off and are gone? Do any of them hang around or what?
No, I think that, you know, it's interesting. You know, it's kind of like I always tell people, it's kind of like, you know, if you're in a critical care, you know, at the hospital, you know, people are going to be patting you on the hand and calling you honey, and you know, you're going to allow that. But at some point, you know, when you check out, you know, you're not going to be wanting to come back, and that's pretty much the same attitude. You know, they leave, and you know, they might turn around and look back. We occasionally have them circle, but you know, there's none of that longing to be with us.
Marge Gibson is our guest today. Marge is with the Raptor Education Group in Anigo, Wisconsin. She got it going, as a matter of fact. Marge is a well-known licensed raptor rehabilitator, and we're really pleased to have her with us today. If you have a question, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890, and email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking raptors and raptor rehabilitation today with Marge Gibson of the Raptor Education Group, Anigo, Wisconsin. And again, give us a call at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And let's go back to the phones and to Michelle in Black River Falls next. Michelle, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a friend who actually her husband is in the DNR, and she said there's a great need for raptor rehabilitators around here because as it is, they have to drive them to Madison. And I've wanted to do it, and I'm not quite sure how to go about it and talk my husband into it at the same time.
Yeah.
If it's a big to-do sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, bless you for thinking about it. I think that, you know, there really does need to be more people that are involved in caring for wildlife. On the other hand, it is a process, and to work with birds, any avian species, you have to be federally permitted as well as state. So there is a process of applying for permits and then, of course, doing, you know, year-end reports and everything that you do goes through the federal government and the state. But having said that, you know, it's an incredible opportunity to to share, you know, your time and life with just amazing species, and to have that close contact that you would not have, you know, anywhere else. It's time consuming. Your husband may take a little bit of talking there. I know it's a good thing my husband didn't know before we started this. But anyway, and it's very expensive. There's no, you know, it's all privately funded. We don't get any funding from the state or federal government. So you end up having to have, I guess, some maybe funding sources lined up. But, you know, I'd be happy to help you offline if you'd, you know, like to call at another time.
Mm-hmm. But you're going to spend, it's not just a one-day workshop to learn how to do this.
No, that's true. And, in fact, in our state we have a compulsory 1,200 hours that people have to put in before they can apply for their own permit. So it would be kind of an intensive volunteer time, basically, what it is. But, you know, it's 24/7. You know, you don't take vacations unless you have coverage. You know, baby birds have to be fed every 20 minutes when they come in. So, you know, our summers are very long days, 20-hour days without any exceptions.
Wow. There you have it, Michelle.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. How do people contact you? You've got a website, and that's kind of cool.
I do, raptoreducationgroup.org. And our phone to the clinic is 715-623-4015.
Run that by me once more. 715
623-4015.
Okay. All right. Michelle, thanks again. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to John in Wausau next. John, hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Quick question, and then I'll take my answer off the air. It was mentioned that, you know, the birds, they start getting along with each other or something along that. I'm wondering if your guest could comment on, like, the social hierarchy among birds, and does it seem to depend upon the species, or does it more dependent upon, you know, the birds picking up on how ill one is, you know, versus another? So understand my question.
Yes, and in fact, it's a little bit of all of that. A lot has to do also with food availability, of course, and a low stress situation. One of the things when the birds are in rehabilitation, whether in the flight building or in other areas, we try to keep their stress to a real low level, and that really helps them to recover and to to interact with each other on a more casual basis.
Yeah,
seem to get along well, or is there some kind of notable hierarchy, or will they all fight if the food is scarce? Or?
Well, I guess I wouldn't call it a hierarchy. If you're, you know, certain species, of course, you have to segregate. Just because, for instance, owls are awake at night and hawks aren't, so it wouldn't be quite fair to have them, you know, together. Again, in a low stress situation, you don't want to put, you know, a bird in with, you know, that has a prey species that's, you know, in the same cage. It wouldn't work out. But they really, as far as fighting when they're together, I mean, there's a lot of birds that are territorial. Eagles, for instance, are notably territorial. But when they're in captivity, that doesn't pertain to them.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
Well, it is. But when we think about it, the reason that they're territorial is because to defend a nest or to defend their family.
Okay.
And while they're with us, you know, that doesn't exist. They're just, you know, individuals, surviving and, doing their own thing until they can get back out there and get back with their mate and, you know, take up that territorial situation again.
Yeah, interesting.
Oh, fascinating. I said I was going to take my answer off the air, but thank you very much.
Thank you for your question.
Thanks, John. Thanks a lot for calling. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call if you would like to join in. And some more callers online. We'll take some calls in just a second. But on your website, there is a shot or a picture of a snowy owl, immature snowy owl, suffering from some emaciation and some respiratory difficulty. And you have incubators, actually, to help in those kinds of situations.
Right. You know, rehabilitation here is really not so different than if you were to go to an emergency room yourself. we have to keep the patients warm, and we have to, you know, keep them well hydrated. Obviously, a nutrition source going in all the time, and many times it's a liquid nutrition at first if they're starving, like in the case of the snowy owl. Of interest, I found one of my own birds this morning. Not my own birds, but I found a young screech owl on my porch this morning when I got up at 4 o'clock. So, you know, I happen to have a starving brand-new patient here right now with me. And it's, you know, keeping them warm, keeping them in an incubator, again, well hydrated and good nutrition is just the key to success for them.
Well, that owl knew where to go.
My husband was saying we have a sign outside saying walk-in clinic. But, you know, normally we never find our birds that are our patients by ourselves. They're all brought to us in some, you know, in some way, either through the public or through the DNR or Fish and Wildlife Service. So this was kind of, not kind of, it was very unusual. I woke up and, you know, see this little guy sitting on the porch, and he was sort of sitting right by the door saying, hey, help, 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 I'm really hungry and I don't know where to go.
Oh, that's great. You know, this takes a lot of money, and how are you funded?
Well, not well. I think that's kind of the big thing. It's all by donations. Mm. We've used a lot of our own retirement fund, unfortunately, and but it's difficult not to want to help them when you're in the middle of it, I guess, and. So it's all donations, and it's so important to have public funding.
Yeah, it's so. And if people, and I'll mention this later again too, but if people are interested in helping with the funding, how do they do that?
Well, we're a nonprofit, 501c3, so all donations are tax deductible, and you can either contact us through the website or at our post office box. It's Raptor Education Group, P.O. Box 481. And Antigo, 54409.
Okay. I'm interesting. You mentioned the young owl, saw it all. And I know you get young predators in, probably. Would you get more young than old predators, raptors?
Well, you know, it depends on the year. There are times when we call them tornado babies, if we'd have a heavy tornado season, and young are still in the nest. The tornadoes go through, and of course the nests come down, and you know, we get a lot of babies that way. But it really depends on the year. I would say mostly we get injured adults or adults that are sick in some way.
I was thinking about the young because I would assume one of your roles is being willing to be able to teach young predators to how to hunt.
Well, we actually have a really good system here, and something that about, maybe 15 years ago, we developed almost by accident. We use a lot of foster parents, and by that, it's their own species. For instance, we have an eagle foster parent. We have red-tailed hawk, great-horned owls. I mean, almost all of the species, including robins, that would be foster parents. They're non-releasable adults that are living with us permanently. They can't be released to the wild. And when we get babies in of their species, we simply build sort of a nest or a nest platform, kind of plop the baby in there, and then just supply food. And they do everything else. They really are incredible parents. And I think that the train of thought perhaps used to be that, you know, perhaps they would, you know, eat the baby or hurt the baby because it's not theirs. But we don't see that happening. It would be the rare situation. In fact, it's never happened here. So they actually are trained by their own species, and it really works out well for us.
We got an email in from Audrey, I believe, or Marge. I'm sorry, Audrey in Brundage. Anyway, she had an injured eagle caught at her home last fall, and it was sent to the Raptor Center, and she was hoping to find out whether or not that eagle survived. And it may be hard for you to remember back to last fall, but
you know, it's we can certainly find out if I can find the you know, the date it was sent here, and you know, I can get back with her if she wants to give us a call, you know, at our clinic number.
Yeah. Okay. So, Audrey, give a call there, and 715-623-4015 is that phone number, And you can find out just if you've got the date. That's the important thing.
Right, the date when they come in. We get so many birds, it's hard to hard to remember them all. But once we have a date, we can go back in the files and find out.
Let's go to the phones again and to Chris in Fox Valley. Chris, hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was wondering the protocol. I found an owl on the road, hit by a vehicle, and I called the Oshkosh DNR, and I left it there, and then my wife was concerned. I showed it to her, and we boxed it up, and probably shouldn't have, but I did, and took it home. And I called the DNR, and they said put it back and let nature take care of itself, and I was kind of bothered by that, so what I did was I dropped it off at the DNR's office early in the morning before they were open. But I what is the protocol on something like that? I mean, I could see it was blind out of one eye, and I could see that. But over the night, it must have had like swelling or something because it was much livelier come morning and when I checked on it. So what is the protocol on something like that?
Well, I think that, what you did calling the DNR, people don't realize that the DNR's role in wildlife has really gone down with cutbacks. They've had a lot of cutbacks in the DNR, and unfortunately wildlife is the one that takes the biggest hit. So they're not as involved as they were at one point in time. And I think that you're not alone. Most people these days, whereas maybe 20, 30 years ago, letting nature take its course was the thing that people thought was the right thing to do. But that's not as acceptable anymore. General public, if they find a bird that's been hit or hurt, you have 24 hours to get it to a rehabilitator. And the DNR does have lists of rehabilitators in areas. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of rehabilitators. We need more to cover the entire state. But hopefully that's exactly what happened. They were able to get it to a rehabilitator when they opened their office.
Okay. I was just wondering, because, we are taught, being a sportsman and stuff, that you're not allowed to mess with raptors, and then that even carry a feather is illegal the way I understand it, so.
Well, it's true. I mean, to have a feather is illegal, and to possess the bird is illegal. However, if you find it and it needs help, getting it into a cardboard box safely, and that can be a bit of a trick. You need to have some sort of guidance in doing that. And then, getting it transported to a wildlife rehabilitator is not illegal. And, in fact, that's the Good Samaritan Act or something like that. But you do have to turn it over as quickly as you can. You can't keep it for a week or for 2 days or something. Mm-hmm. It needs to be turned over right away.
Right. Mm-hmm. I did that. I was just wondering if my wife and I still talk about that. I was wondering if we did the right thing.
They're really incredible, and I think that that's the thing. Once people have an interaction with a wild species, it's such a compelling thing. It's very hard to not hold them in your thoughts.
Yeah, that's for sure. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234, or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm wondering, you mentioned, we talked about West Nile a little bit, and in order to figure out if a bird has something like West Nile or anything else for that matter, you have to do some testing. What kinds of testing do you do, and how do you actually do the tests? I mean, you probably draw some blood.
First we do. We Raptor Education Group works a lot with Marshfield Medical Labs, medical research, and again, the state funding was cut in that area as well. So we do a lot of independent research on this. You do a culture of the throat. And they can try to grow the culture and see if it has any virus on it. The other way is through blood, and they do titers on the blood to see if they've had the disease or if they have a current active disease.
Mike in Appleton is up next, so let's go to Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How are you guys doing today?
Great. Thank you for calling.
It's a great show, and I'm glad to see there's more people getting involved with saving birds. I had a really wild experience some years ago, and I still don't believe it actually happened, but coming through Stevens Point, just coming out the west side, an owl got hit right where that river goes through by that park there. Maybe you know where that is. And the owl got hit and went end over end and landed on the sidewalk, and then it was kind of in the gutter. Well, I stopped my car, and I picked it up and threw it in the back seat because I figured it was still alive, and I figured I'd get it, you know, out of the roadway. And I put it in the back of my car, a little hatchback, and then as I drove down the road, I'm trying to think, where shall I take this thing? And I got out of Stevens Point, and I thought, well, I'll take it all the way to Fox Valley and figure out somewhere down here. And I stopped on County Trunk A, and it was sitting on my back seat looking at me, this huge owl. And I remember when I picked him up and carried him to my car, his breath stunk just terrible of rotten meat.
Mouse breath. Yeah. That would be mouse breath.
Gosh, he stunk, you know. And anyway, I opened my hatchback, and he hopped down onto the ledge of it, and then he flew away, and he seemed fine.
You know, they really are resilient, and I think that having had that kind of experience, it's something that, you know, we can't tell people. You almost have to have that kind of experience. They're intelligent beyond what people have any idea, and very adaptable. And I think, you know, one of the signs of intelligence is being adaptable. And, you know, she kind of woke up in your car and thought, gosh, you know, okay, well, this is different. But, you know, they're not the, you know, full-on attack, you know, predator sort of thing that people think of or when they conjure up in their mind, especially if you're not going to hurt them. And they really evaluate that quickly and appropriately.
Yeah. Well, I've still got talon holes in my upholstery.
I bet.
Well, he needed to sit up straight, I guess. Yeah.
I showed my wife, and she said she didn't believe me. Because
yeah.
He didn't leave a feather, didn't leave a tuft of anything in my car, so I had just holes.
Well, Mike, that's a great story. Thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it. Jan in South Wayne has a question or comment for you. Jan, hello.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Marge.
Thanks
for taking my call. Marge, I heard you tell a story about the hungry owl, I believe, that showed up on your porch.
That was this morning, yes.
Has all of the snow that we've been receiving this winter, has that contributed to them, you know, a lack of food source?
I'm sorry. What has contributed is not only the snow, but we have had some ice layers between the snow layers. And that, as far as barred owls, we have 7 in our clinic right now, as a matter of fact, and suffering starvation. A lot of the owls actually hear mice underneath the snow, and they dive through the snow. It's called snow plunging. And so they can hear this. They start to dive, and they hit ice, and they can't go through that. So basically, they start starving. The extreme cold weather has been another difficult situation. They tend to go into sort of a shutdown, and they don't eat much when it's really cold. Their systems, including their intestines and everything, start slowing down. So they're not able to digest food, and therefore they're not hunting. They're saving calories. But when we have a sustained cold weather, like we've had this year, the little ones, the ones with small body mass, saw-wits, even barred owls because they're smaller in stature, and screech owls, are less able, they have less stores, so they're less able to get through this period of time, which is now we're starting to get a lot of starved birds in, and that's what happened with this little guy.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Edie in Baraboo. Hi, Edie.
Hi. I have a question about little screech owls. Sometimes when I go out in the barn, 11:30, 12, 1 o'clock, you know, check on the animals before I go to bed, in the back will be a little screech owl, and he flies out, and the sheep live back there in the night, you know, at night. Do they get sparrows?
They can, but basically they're probably finding little mice that come to, you know, in the sheep bedding and things like that. They're really very active and successful mousers. They eat 2 to 3 mice a day. And so they're probably back there mousing or getting small rats or anything that else might happen to be back there.
But they wouldn't be getting little sparrows and stuff like that.
Well, they could, but see, they're, again, it's a matter of they're active at night and the sparrows are actually, you know, are sleeping. And so unless they, you know, can figure out where they're sleeping, which, you know, they're actually looking for movement and they're hearing. Owls use 60% of their hunting ability is hearing. And so they really need to hear something walking or moving before they're attracted to it.
Interesting.
If I would open up the top sliding door of the barn at night, do you think that it would go, a little thing would go in there?
You know, I don't know.
It's pretty big.
I don't know. It would depend on, you know, if it might feel like it would be trapped or something inside. And if it has a mate there, it would, you know, it would make a big difference if he's only hunting at your barn or if he's actually living there. And it's hard to tell right now with what that would be.
I think we had one just a couple weeks ago was smushed on the road in the morning. So that probably maybe
probably its mate. Yeah, probably its mate. So it's probably just hanging out, waiting for its mate to return. They have a long mate fidelity, and he's probably waiting. Yeah, it's getting close to their breeding season. Owls are our earliest breeders. In fact, great horned owls are probably down on eggs by now, and this time would start, their hormones are starting to flow, and he's starting to think about, you know, visions of little eggs in the nest sort of thing.
Well, I think I'll try the barn door and see if maybe he can go in and find some mice upstairs.
As long as you don't have any rodent poisoning out,
No, I don't at all.
Yeah, and that's a real important element, because if they get a mouse that has had some poison, they will be poisoned in a secondary way, and we actually receive a lot of birds that are poisoned like that.
Okay. Yeah, I don't put it out now anymore. So
good job.
Okay.
Thanks a lot
for
calling, Edie. Appreciate it. And Marge, thank you so much. I know you and I'll be together on Tuesday evening, March 18th, for the Madison Audubon Society Spring Banquet. I'm looking forward to that. You're bringing some birds along with you.
I am. I'm going to bring a few that are people don't see all the time. A red-shouldered hawk, and I think my turkey vulture will be up for the traveling as well. And so we'll be bringing a few unusual birds along with maybe a few that are more normal, like the solid owl, which is always a real favorite of people.
Oh, sure. And again, thank you so much. And Marge, as I said, I'll be the master of ceremonies for that evening event. That's Tuesday, March 18th from 5:30 to 9 p.m. at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Memorial Union on Langdon Street. And tickets are available. You can go online to madisonaudubon.org, madisonaudubon.org, and get tickets that way. Or just call area 608-255-2473, 608-255-2473. And if you'd like to make a contribution to Marge and her group at the Raptor Education Group in Antigo, Wisconsin, I hope you'll certainly consider that. Go to raptoreducationgroup.org, raptoreducationgroup.org. You can find out there. Or, again, you can call their number, and that's 715-623-4015. Thanks a lot, Marge.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing you.
Yeah, you too. Me too. Marge Gibson of the Raptor Education Group, Antigo, Wisconsin. She's a well-known licensed Raptor rehabilitator, and as you heard, she knows an awful lot about raptors and about rehabilitating them. Well, coming up, we're going to take a look at an initiative to answer some questions about how climate change would affect Wisconsin. You may have some thoughts about that or some questions about that, too. Coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.